What's the relationship between neurological disorders and suicide?
Do lifestyle changes substitute or complement medications?
How do changes in prescribing laws relate to people being able to get naloxone?
And an update on the coronavirus infection.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, in keeping with what we've been doing, I think we should start first by updating our listeners on what we know about the coronavirus.
This is the largest report of hospitalized patients with coronavirus. So this is a retrospective series of the 138 consecutive hospitalized patients that have confirmed coronavirus infection. In perspective, although this is a report of 138 consecutive hospitalized patients, there have been over 35,000 infections worldwide, about 700 deaths, that is a mortality of about 2%. But this report centered on the hospitalized patients in Wuhan, China. And what they discovered was that compared to those that were not hospitalized, these patients were likely to be a little bit older, oftentimes over the age of 60, and to have other comorbid conditions. The mortality in these patients was about 4%. Almost 100% had fever, and then about 60% ended up with dyspnea or shortness of breath. They oftentimes had a low white blood cell count, an elevation in LDH, one of the liver enzymes, or enzymes from the red blood cells, and then a slightly elevated prothrombin time. That's usually associated with some sort of liver disease or inflammation. And the chest CT scan typically showed infiltrates in both lung fields. These patients received a number of different therapies. We don't know whether they're beneficial or not. Some of them are antiviral, some were antibacterial, and some of them were treated with steroids as well. The last thing is the median time from when the symptoms started to actually when they developed dyspnea, shortness of breath, was about 5 days. The time to when they hospitalized was about 7 days.
Well, that's interesting. So it's pretty prolonged before people get to the place where they say, hey, I really need to come to the hospital. And have they been putting these people on ventilators?
Some have been on ventilator. About half of them received non-invasive ventilation, and the other half received invasive ventilation. Their median hospital stay was about 10 days.
I think that there's still a lot of things that are really curious, of course, about this virus. It's not surprising that people with comorbidities would be more susceptible and end up hospitalized. I would note that we now have the death of the original whistleblower, the physician who originally identified, ooh, look, it looks like I'm seeing an outbreak, and he was only 32 years old. We also have a death of an American who was 60.
And Elizabeth, let me correct one thing I said. We talked about half the people needing non-invasive, the other half needing invasive ventilation. Those were those admitted to the ICU. That was about a fourth of the patients. One of the things that's really interesting is about 40% of the patients infected was thought to be hospital-related transmission.
Well, this is interesting. So more to come, no doubt, as we've talked about before. So why don't we turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association, something that's also of really huge public health import, at least here in the U.S., and that is this very disturbing increase in suicide and suicidal ideation that we've noted in the last, shall we call it, decade or so. Different groups who are becoming more susceptible to actually either committing suicide or thinking about committing suicide. So I thought this study was really interesting. It took place in Denmark. They have an identifier for every single citizen in the country. So I'm so persuaded by these really enormous data sets. And sure enough, this was a really big one, over 7 million people, representing all people 15 years or older who were living in Denmark from 1980 through 2016. They were looking at the relationship between neurologic conditions and suicidality. I'm going to name them all: head injury, stroke, epilepsy, polyneuropathy, what they call diseases of myoneural junction, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, central nervous system infections, meningitis, encephalitis, ALS, Huntington's disease, dementia, intellectual disability, and others. So during that time period, there were 1.2 million plus people who had one or more of these particular conditions. They had 35,483 people die by suicide. The majority of these were males. They had 44 per 100,000 person years compared with 20.1 per 100,000 person years among those who did not have a neurologic disorder. they were able to look at specific conditions in their relationship with suicidality. To me, not necessarily surprising, they found that ALS and Huntington's disease, those folks were much more likely to commit suicide than people who had other neurologic conditions. Although I also thought it was really interesting that people with Parkinson's disease were about twice as likely to commit suicide as those who did not have that condition.
The authors, rightly so, admit that the overall suicide risk is low among these patients. In fact, over that same time period, Elizabeth, they decreased suicide by 75% across the country by doing things like limiting firearms and limiting toxic medications. But nevertheless, the risk among patients with neurologic disorders was twice as high. One could surmise there are a lot of things that contribute to this. For some people, the burden of the disease upon themselves and their family members is a problem. Some of these things are associated with depression that may or may not have been recognized. Some of them are associated with neuroaggressive behaviors as well. And I think the key point is when we have a patient with neurologic disorders, we need to be cognizant that this is a risk, albeit small. Nevertheless, it's a risk and we need to address it.
And I'm wondering about this point that you brought out about, in fact, in Denmark, they have reduced access to firearms and to other very lethal means to attempt or commit suicide. We don't enjoy that luxury here in the U.S.
No, and they certainly link their 75% reduction in suicide to these two measures in large part. These patients with neurologic disorders often have difficult communicating in general. As healthcare providers or as individuals that know people like this, we need to be able to freely communicate so we can prevent it.
Right. So awareness, of course, is key.
So Elizabeth, I teed up the next one about lifestyle changes. Does it substitute or does it complement for medications? And perhaps I should have framed it the other way around. Do medications substitute or complement lifestyle changes? We know that when somebody has a hard diagnosis, they have cardiovascular disease, or they're diagnosed with diabetes, oftentimes it triggers lifestyle changes, things like weight loss and an increase in physical activity, decreasing alcohol consumption, and even contributing to smoking cessation. But less hard things like the diagnosis of high cholesterol or hypertension triggers the use of medications. And the question is, in those individuals, does it also trigger lifestyle changes? And to address that, these authors looked at over 41,000 participants in what's called the Finnish Public Sector Study. These were people that are over the age of 40 who did not have cardiovascular disease, but during the period between 2000 and 2013, they were diagnosed with hypertension or hypercholesterolemia, and as a result, placed on antihypertensive meds or on statin-lower therapy. Did those things trigger or were they associated with lifestyle changes? And what they found was that, unfortunately, it was a mixed bag. Those individuals who started on medications had an increase in their body mass index, they were more likely to become obese, and they were more likely to be physically inactive than individuals that were not started on medications. Conversely, however, they had a greater decline in alcohol consumption and a higher odds of quitting smoking. What they recommend is, with this information, what could we do different? Weight management and physical activity should be encouraged in individuals who are prescribed these medications, knowing that it's more likely individuals will be moving in an unfavorable position with regard to these two lifestyle changes.
I think it's just so sad. And I think it speaks to our national and probably international predilection toward taking medications and thinking that, I'm on a medication, now I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, now in fairness, this is just an association. It's a report. So it's hard to say that medications made people say, I don't have to exercise or I can gain weight, because there are a lot of confounders as well. What you would hope, though, as you said, is that when people are diagnosed with something, they get serious about it and say, listen, these things contribute to the risk of diabetes and heart disease and stroke and kidney disease. And what can I do within my control to change those things? And obviously, becoming more physically active and losing weight lowers the risk of all those things and the risk of cancer as well.
And may even enable them to go off of these medicines, which at least my predilection is toward not having to take a medicine if I don't have to. Let's mention that this is the Journal of the American Heart Association. I think we neglected that.
Thank you, Elizabeth. You're right. The first therapy in treating hypertension and lowering cholesterol should be lifestyle changes. And medications should not substitute for those. They should complement those lifestyle changes.
Let's turn now to JAMA Network Open. This is a look at how does access to naloxone, of course, the medication that reverses opioid overdose, change when laws are changed, enabling pharmacists to dispense this drug without a prescription. This is a study that took place in Ohio, and Ohio, of course, is ground zero in many respects for the whole opioid overdose epidemic. They said, well, all right, once we change the laws and we say that pharmacists are able to just give this to people when they perceive or when they're asked for it, that it's needed, what happens with regard to actually dispensing it. It's a really simple study, and it doesn't really look at the hard outcomes, which is something that I would have welcomed. But they basically showed that after this policy was implemented, the dispensing of naloxone increased by over 2,300%. So previous to it, there were only 191 dispensations, if you will, and that increased to 4,637 in the post-policy period. I view this as a really good thing. Naloxone is not a medication that you really need a PhD or an MD to administer, and it's extremely effective for most opioid overdoses, and so at least I think this is good news.
And Elizabeth, I should point out that even though the pharmacists were prescribing this without getting a prescription, these were all physician-approved protocols. So it talks about how the two groups, the physicians and pharmacists, are working together. And as you highlighted, the number of naloxone prescriptions increased 2,300, but it really doesn't tell us did that reduce opioid-related deaths. Just so that our listeners are aware, the FDA is actually considering making naloxone over-the-counter for this particular reason. Now, the advantage of having the pharmacists involved is they can identify people at risk, that is, people that are picking up an opioid prescription for themselves or a family member, would trigger an alarm, so the pharmacist would be able to talk to that individual and say, listen, you may need, or your family member or friend may need naloxone, and here's why. Being able to identify these patients at risk by the pharmacist, this is not something the physician would have available to him or her necessarily. So I think this is a good news story. Will it decrease overall opioid morbidity? Not known. The other thing about this that was helpful was, not only did it increase naloxone prescribing, but it did so particularly among Medicaid patients and those who were unemployed. And those are the highest risk patients in terms of opioid-related deaths.
Exactly. So I'm actually really happy to see that we're moving in that direction. On that note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.